This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay. So, good afternoon, everybody. This is Macro's teleconference series, and I'm Rachel Wohl. I'm the director of Macro. And this recording is being, this telephone call is being recorded. And I would ask that you put yourself on mute. Star 6 will mute, and then you have to do star 6 again to unmute, because this is going to be a question and answer, and hope it's a lively, interactive conversation on this call. I want to ask everyone to please not press hold. Don't put this call on hold at any time during the teleconference. The hold music comes on and it drowns out the call. So please don't put your phones on hold, and please mute yourself unless and until you have a question to ask. So I know that many of you listening were introduced to Anna Spain in the webinar that she did on May 22nd on mediating race, culture, and ethnicity, an identity-based approach. And it was fascinating, and it was so fascinating that we wanted more, and so did others, so we're bringing her back again. And we especially wanted to talk to Anna about how these issues play out in specific cases and what mediators should and shouldn't do. I just want to say a word about Anna. Many of you were introduced to her on May 22nd. She is an associate professor at the University of Colorado Law School. She's had over 17 years of mediation experience. She teaches, writes, practices mediation, international dispute resolution, and works with identity-based conflicts. She was previously an attorney advisor at the State Department, and she served on the board of Mediators Beyond. And Anna has a JD from Harvard Law School and is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Good afternoon, Anna.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor and pleasure to join today, and I am going to just provide a few minutes of background before opening up this forum to hear from you, to hear your questions, your ideas, so that we might have a more robust discussion about this very important topic. In part one of this series provided by Macro, I was discussing how we should go about mediating issues of race, culture, and ethnicity. And I did so by providing a framework which I call an identity-based approach. But before providing information on that, I just want to say that today is a very special day for our country. June 19th is also known as Juneteenth, and this is a day that commemorates the announcement of the emancipation of slavery. Back in 1865, the Union troops, led by General Granger, ended up in Galveston, Texas, and they reread President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which was issued on September 22, 1862. So several years after emancipation, many people were still in slavery. And this day was a day that a lot of people found out for the first time that they had been freed. So it's both a commemoration of that day as well as a celebration of freedom and the end of slavery everywhere in the United States. And so I think it's an appropriate historical reminder of the importance that, you know, our shared history in this country through many, many eras of history, through slavery and the Civil War, through immigration, that has helped define our national identity. And part of our national identity is our race, our culture, and our ethnicity. So the question for all of us who are in this important field of mediation and dispute resolution and conflict resolution is, how do we encourage people to engage in respectful and constructive dialogue about these very difficult but important topics? And in part one, which you can find on Macro's website, there's a recording with a copy of my presentation, provided just basic definitions and context for how we can think about these elements. And I basically argue that for all of us, every time we are in the mediation room. Identity is a part of the dispute. And one way to think about issues of race, culture, and ethnicity is that they are elements, along with gender, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, and other things, that will form each and every person's identity. So identity is both individual, and I talk about the importance of allowing people to self-identify, but it's also societal. What makes sense in the U.S. context does not necessarily make sense in other parts of the world. So I'm just going to briefly recap two specific mediation cases that I was involved with as examples of both how issues of race and ethnicity came out and my approach using the identity approach to dealing with them in those particular settings. The first mediation case is an explicit example where I was mediating for a federal government agency where a GS-15 employee had filed an EEOC claim against her supervisor.
Anna, you're breaking up. Anna?
Hello?
Yes, all right, I hear you now. You were breaking up.
Okay. And the claim was for non-promotion due to discrimination on the basis of race. And in this setting, the GS-15 employee was an African-American woman. She was in her mid-40s, and her supervisor was a white male, and he was in his early 60s. And they had been through an informal process that brought them to mediation. I met with them. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. And I met with them individually to really hear what was at the core of their concerns. Ultimately, the GF-15 employee explained to me that she really felt that she was qualified to be promoted into this higher position, and it was really important for her career that she get promoted, but that the reason she thought she was not promoted was that she believed that her supervisor was racist.
And Anna, and just a minute. I just want to reiterate that if please put your calls on *6 because we're hearing background noise. So please hit *6, which will mute you. Thank you. And don't put the call on hold for any reason. Thank you. I'm sorry, Anna. Go ahead.
And she explained to me that she believed that he was not telling her the truth, and she wanted to hear the truth. In my private meeting with him, he was really a bit concerned about how he should communicate with me. And I had to do a lot of work to gain his trust and to encourage him to be honest, even if he didn't have the right words or language, and to have him feel that in that moment he could say what he needed to say and it wouldn't leave the room. He did reveal that while he did not believe that he was racist, he did know that he had certain biases that led to this decision that he did not feel that this employee was right for the job. He explained to me that although she was qualified substantively, she knew her material, she could outperform many of her peers, part of the new position required her to be a public spokesperson for the agency. And he believed that her look was not right for the job. He specifically talked about her hair, her makeup, the way that she dressed, the clothes that she chose, her type of jewelry, her ability to deliver public speeches, and that he wanted to make sure that whoever was in this position who was going to be representing the agency had, in his estimation, a certain professionalized look. Now, he knew that he was on shaky ground to say this information to her, and he was not willing to do that. In talking with her again in a private caucus, I helped her understand what her options were, what would be the best outcome for her. Would she like to win the claim? And she ultimately said, I don't care about winning or losing. I just want this job. And I want to know why I didn't get it. And I'd rather have an honest conversation, even if that means that, things are said that will offend me, then you make this go away and win my case. So ultimately, after some time, we worked as a group to build enough trust.
Hello?
To learn the appropriate language for these two individuals to share their honest perspectives about the other.
And those honest perspectives were definitely offensive. But it was the act of being able to know why that helped her as an individual come to terms with the reality of why this was so painful for her. And ultimately, skipping ahead to the end, they worked out an agreement where she was going to be promoted, and in exchange she agreed to take public speaking lessons and to, you know, redefine her look. Now, that's not something by law that she has to do. She certainly has rights in the legal proceedings that would protect her from that. But that was something that she definitively chose because she wanted to further her career and was willing to take the dangerous path of hearing things that were not comfortable to hear. Whether they were right or wrong, I think many of us have opinions about that, and as a mediator, I certainly did. But it was up to me to promote the self-determination of my clients and to help them understand what their options were and how to proceed in a conversation with some safety net, knowing that there was still opportunity where they might be offended.
And it sounds like...
Rachel?
I just wanted to say, it sounds like if you had not given them the opportunity, you know, in caucus to talk about this freely and to decide whether or not they, you know, felt it was safe to talk about it together, that this whole issue might never have been touched, right?
Yes, and I think the hard part for me as both an attorney and a mediator is that as an attorney, I knew that it was well within her rights to succeed on her claim.
Uh-huh.
But as a mediator, I understood that for her personally, 10 years down the line, she wanted to have this career, and that was more important to her than proving that this supervisor was in the wrong. Mm-hmm. And at a great personal cost and definitely taking a courageous path, she was able to work with us to forge a path ahead.
Great.
The second example, and I raise this because I think this is the more common example and also the more challenging example for mediators, is when issues of race, culture, and ethnicity are implicit, i.e. they're not something that are on the table. None of your clients have come into the room and said to you, this is what's going on, I believe this is the reason. And yet you as a mediator sense that identity is a part of the dispute. And the example I have here is a mediation I conducted for a university between a department chair and a professor. The professor was a woman who was in her 30s, and the chair was a man, and he was in his late 50s. And she had filed an administrative claim through the university against him on the basis of sexual harassment. This had gone on for 5 years and was about to leave the university process and head to litigation. When all parties involved decided to give mediation a try, and it was the first time they did so. There were deep rifts within the department. People had taken sides for either the woman or the man, and so the dispute had grown. So it was no longer just between the two core stakeholders, but it had grown to involve many other people. At the mediation, it was just the woman, the man, and myself to start. And I encouraged that in order to encourage a chance for them to talk with each other. They had not actually had a face-to-face conversation for 3 years prior to the mediation. And a lot of escalation had occurred during this time. Essentially, after hearing their stories, it turned out that she was his protege. He had helped have her hired into the department, and he had guided her career early on and helped mentor her and had a lot of hope that she would become a nationally renowned scholar in her field. And she was doing really, really well. And then she took maternity leave. She had 2 children pre-tenure. And during that time, their relationship cooled. After that time, in lots of faculty meetings and public settings, he made comments against her that she felt were sexually harassing, and that's what led to the claim. I sensed that something was going on here because they had this close connection early on that had to do with their individual identities. And indeed, after encouraging them to talk about why they wanted to get into this field, what they enjoyed about it, where they came from. I found out that they did have an identity aspect to the dispute, and I'll explain that briefly. He was raised in India and in a very male-centric society where he did not have a lot of professional contact with women. And it was a big deal for him to promote a woman, to mentor a woman, to reach out and believe in her, to put his reputation on the line, as he saw it, for her career. And when she, in his estimation, chose to have a family that detracted from her ability to be as productive, he felt slighted, and he felt like it had directly gone to his reputation. And these feelings led him to make comments that were definitely detrimental and negative. She was somebody who was born in Russia. She self-identified as being Jewish, and her family was persecuted there and left, ultimately migrating to Israel. And from there, she came to the United States. And her education was the key to freedom in her family history. It was the way up and out. And she had worked really hard to get a position of security. And to her, that was getting the job. And once she had some security, she felt it equally important to begin a family and to make family a part of her life. So after they shared their deep histories and backgrounds, they came to the realization that ultimately they did respect each other. Ultimately, they did understand where the other one was coming from. And things had gone awry during the 5 years that this conflict had grown. They decided, in addition to some other procedural aspects, to agree to do a joint public apology in front of their entire department and to have an outward sign of reconciliation to say to everyone, if we, at the core of this, can reconcile with each other, the rest of you can too. And so part of their way forward was not just resolving their own dispute, but helping resolve the dispute that had grown between other members of their department. So both of these are just short examples of both an explicit case and an implicit case where race, culture, and ethnicity have come up in the mediation room. And again, I argue that we really need to, as mediators, to be prepared to encourage discussion about issues of identity. And to do that, we also have to become comfortable having those discussions ourselves. So I want to take a pause at this time to open things up to all of you who are on the line, to encourage your questions and your dialogue about any of these issues and anything that you want to talk about.
And you need to hit *6 to unmute to ask a question. And whatever, if you're not asking a question, please have yourself on *6. Please have yourself muted. Someone is not muted and is creating background noise. So please hit *6 and don't put the call on hold. So any questions on *6? It'd be good to hear about other people's cases and how they've dealt with these issues and questions that you have for Anna. What came to me, Anna, about what the last story you just said is that, you know, I think it's common for mediators to ask the parties about the history of their relationship, but I don't know that it's so common for people to ask, really, who are you? Where do you come from? Help us understand who you are. And I don't know really how you do that.
Well, again, as many of you will recall from part one, my advice and guidance is that obviously every situation is unique. And so in giving advice and guidance, it's easier to do with specific situations. And in that situation, I think just understanding and appreciating that each person that comes to work with you in mediation is truly a unique individual. And everybody has their story. Everybody has the past that influences present behavior. And so making sure that you find a way to tap into that and make space where people can talk about those things if they choose to is essential, because it is already part of them, so it's already affecting their decision making. And in this particular case with the university example, it was clear that in addition to both parties having a lot of negative emotions
toward the other person. Underneath the negative emotions came views about how they saw each other that was deeply entrenched in their own personal history. Mm-hmm. So my identity as an individual often shapes my interaction with other people because I'm interpreting who they are, how they're behaving, what assumptions I think they're making, what biases I think they might have through the lens of my take on their identity. And opening it up to have a conversation about identity allows a lot of the assumptions to be corrected. So instead of me thinking I know everything there is to know about the person sitting across the room from me, I actually learn something that I didn't expect. And furthermore, in listening to their story, I can connect a part of myself and my past to a part of them. And that helps build empathy, which we all know can be essential to helping reconciliation.
So what specifically do you do to encourage people to self-identify?
So I think, you know, often depending on your style of mediation, once you have a joint caucus where people have shared aspects of their view on what's going on, you can see early on where their identity is starting to come out. So many times people, if they're in a situation where they want to make it about the numbers or they want to make it about specific technical issues, the way that they talk about that, you'll start to see that there's more to the story. And when you get a glimpse that there's more, asking them questions as if you really do care about understanding their point of view will encourage them to start talking and sharing with you what's really going on in their mind. And I think beyond the mental and even the emotional level, once they start to share, you can again ask deeper questions to say, for example, where does this particular understanding come from? How did you get to this point? And where, you know, based on your experience, have you developed an understanding for what's going on? So just, you know, it's hard to say in general what questions you should ask. There's no script that you can use. But the intention of trying really to go deep with them and understand who are they and what is it about their life and their lived experience help them get to the point they are in this mediation. Now, again, many times people won't feel comfortable doing that in a joint session. So using private sessions or caucuses to encourage this kind of sharing can be essential in the beginning until you build up some level of trust between yourself and your clients and ultimately between the clients themselves.
Oh, thanks. Before continuing the conversation with you, I want to just make a space if there's anyone who wants to ask a question or make a comment.
This is Tim Stranges. So I have a question.
Go ahead, Tim.
Please.
Okay. Last night, our mediators group, discussion group that meets once a month, had a discussion about a statement we thought you said last month in your webinar, and that was, whenever race is present in a mediation, it may very well be an issue, regardless of whether it's a small claims case or something that presents as not related to race at all. Could you further clarify that?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So many of you saw the initial announcement for part one, which was the webinar, and in that description, I basically say this very point, which is that it's my belief based on experience and research that identity, however you want to describe that, is present in each and every dispute. So many of us, when we learned about conflict resolution and we learned about mediation, we might have come across the diagram of the iceberg of conflict. Or if you've taken up getting to yes, you understand the differences between issue versus the underlying interest. So what someone wants versus why they want it. And what I'm saying is underneath both issues and the interests are the identities of people. So identity in America includes race. And race is an important part of both how individuals see themselves and how society views groups of people. Now, this is definitely something that many people have
argued that we should get away from, but the reality on the ground is that we're still, it's still very much a part of our national identity in America. So race as a component of identity is a part of every dispute, because identity is a part of every dispute. Because you're not, you can't take the identity out of the person and expect that she or he will just engage on an issue, this is, you know, this is what I want, or an interest, this is why I want it level. But ultimately, who they are is shaping both their, how they view the issues as well as what their interests are. So I don't know if that goes to your question.
Oh, it does. It does. Thank you so much for the clarification.
This is Larry Schooler. Could I jump in?
Sure. Sure.
I just wanted to share a very recent experience last night, actually, in which I'm sort of dealing with a multi-party dispute over a sort of cherished park area that's being master planned. And, you know, race wasn't overtly discussed, but the room was heavily Hispanic in terms of the neighborhood representatives. And alongside of those neighborhood representatives were a very small number of white folks who work for sort of citywide organizations like a Trail Foundation or a Parks Foundation. And it became very clear that, you know, what was good for the neighborhood and what was good for the city as it relates to this park might not be the same thing. And I think that for a lot of people in the room, they feel that this effort has been sort of hoisted upon them by folks other than themselves who don't necessarily have their best interests. And part of the backdrop for this is a power plant that was being decommissioned that affected the park life. So I guess it's a very long way of saying that in our debrief this morning, we've been talking about how it might have been good for us to spend a little bit more time allowing the participants to, you know, sort of speak about what they have dealt with in their history in the eastern part of Austin where I live, and the ongoing challenges, and how their identity has been wrapped up in this power plant and this you know, park now coming to life. Rather than sort of diving right into work and asking them for input. So I guess I'm sort of seconding what the speaker said and maybe looking for some additional guidance where it's sort of a multi-meeting, multi-party kind of situation as opposed to a two-party mediation.
That's an excellent example. Thank you for raising it. I am dealing with a similar public dispute where I live about the siting of a homeless shelter where the people who live in the neighborhood have a different view from the city and the county, and implicitly race is definitely an issue because the makeup of the community that it will affect is very different from the makeup of the decision makers. So I very much relate to that, and I think it's true for many public resource issues, the question of, you know, identity and how it comes out. So a couple of points to potentially help and advise. The first is, and I learned this lesson powerfully along the way, but one poignant example is working in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina with communities in the Ninth Ward as well as other wards who were all trying to do reconstruction. And the majority of the people living in the communities were Black Americans, and yet they didn't want outsiders, who often were not Black Americans, to focus on their identity as placing them all in the same group of interests. So I raise that to say, with your situation where you have a large group of people who, you know, many people may say, okay, well, this group is primarily Hispanic with a minority group of people involved who are white. But beyond that, each of the people involved are individuals. And the allowing them to self-identify and say, you know, do I identify myself as Hispanic? And what does that even mean to me? And how does that influence how I view this project? Do I believe that, you know, this, whether it's the city or another institution, is placing the burden on this group because of our makeup as an identity group? Or do I not see that as being central to what's going on here? So I think finding a way. And this is the tricky part, because a lot of times if the process does not include an opportunity for people to self-identify and talk about the role of their identity, both as individuals and as a larger group,
in the beginning, then you know, people can be angry about that, and that can come out later. So, but finding a way to encourage, to say that that's a part of the process, is having that kind of a conversation. And the idea that certain people are insiders and certain people are outsiders in any group setting. So the insiders, you know, if the insiders identify as insiders because they share a racial or ethnic or cultural background, then what's their view on who belongs to that group and who's on the outside? And the same questions can be asked of people who might be perceived as outsiders. An excellent resource is some of the work by John Paul Lederach, who many of you might be familiar with. He's done a lot of work in ethnic and identity-based conflicts around the world and has dealt with the insider-outsider issue. And so how do you move beyond that to develop some individual-to-individual relationships amongst people within the larger group while still respecting the fact that you have people who majority belong to one group and minority belong to another group, and the historical implications that that has. So what I'm saying, try to be less complicated here, at basic level, is you want to respect history and respect the role that race in this country and racial minorities in this country, some of the hardships that have gone on. So try not to wipe that off the map, but also try to, while acknowledging that, encourage individual-to-individual dialogues and interactions so that people get to know each other beyond these identity groups. And they get to understand, you know, why do you want what you want? Why is it important to you? Is there room for us to figure out what to do with this part?
Thanks very much.
Thank you. More questions, comments, ideas?
And somebody's typing and is not on star six. So, Anna, you know, what if you know that there's an identity issue going on, but one of the participants is not comfortable talking about it?
I think that's obviously a question that will come up. And on the one hand, you can treat it just like you would if you're talking to your client. You're the mediator. You're talking to your client. And you can tell your client is not comfortable sharing information with you. And so whether it's information on race or culture, or whether it's information about a past trauma, whether it's information that's confidential that they don't feel that they can reveal, you know, all of those sorts of things go to the barrier that you have of a trust deficit. And so when you're in a low trust environment, they don't know you, they've just met you, they're not sure what your alliances or agendas are, and you have a lot of work to do, as we all do in mediation, into helping them understand that you are here through process to really figure out a way to further their interest as well as the interest of the other side. So in a low trust environment, a lot of the advice says that you start with respect. Okay, you don't trust me, I don't trust you. Do we respect each other? And underneath respect is the concept of dignity. And I mentioned in my last webinar an excellent book by Donna Hicks. That's Donna Hicks, and it's called Dignity. And it provides specific guidelines for how to engage and communicate with people using dignity as a guiding principle. She explains through several case studies how this works in places where there is no trust, and it is, in my mind, a breakthrough model where, you know, if you don't trust me and I don't trust you, you don't respect me even, can we at least get to a baseline of having dignity, a sense of dignity for the other person, human being to human being? So one approach is to walk back, start at basics, start at foundational level, to build dignity into respect and respect into trust. Another approach is to reveal, you know, this is, again, one of the things that can work really well or not, depending on the situation, but to reveal a part about yourself and your own identity.
that shows that you too are human, you too are vulnerable, you understand where they're coming from or where they might be coming from. And in sharing your a bit of yourself, you're inviting reciprocity. You're asking them to share back with you. Maybe they will and maybe they won't, but that's another technique that's often used to help open things up where someone's reluctant to talk. And the third bit of advice on that would be to, instead of asking direct questions, and this is often a technique people use with children, to use another way to help people tell their story. So, you know, with kids, we often have kids draw pictures or look at games or something to, and then talk about their experience with that. With adults, you know, saying, you know, so what did you think about something external, something that's happening in the world that we can all relate to? And through a conversation about something that's not personal, you'll start to hear them reveal little bits of who they are. And in that, when they do that, you really encourage it and say, well, that's really interesting. Could you explain more? I'd really like to know about that. And to do it with deep sincerity, to do it with a level of respect where you're not just digging for information. You really do care, and you care because as a mediator, the more that you understand them, the better you're going to be able to help guide the process and to help them understand that that's your role, that's your goal, and this is one technique that can help do that.
Thank you. I'll leave a little space for comments, other comments, questions.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This is Chelsea, and I wanted to say, one, thank you for all of your good advice, Anna. I do have one particular question with regards to a past mediation that was known as a restorative dialogue session, where there were two parents who were concerned that their child was being harassed within his neighborhood because of his racial identity. They were very open and candid about their racial identity. However, some of the parties that may have also been involved weren't necessarily at the mediation session. What's the best way to handle future mediations where maybe all of the persons involved aren't necessarily present?
That's a very good question. And I think, you know, so to ask you a question in return so I can give you a better response is, were the people who were not there in the beginning not there for a particular reason? Were they or were they added later on in the process? So they didn't even know it was happening, and then later they decided to join.
Honestly, there was limited information as to why they weren't there. The way that restorative dialogues usually occur is that it's between the family members involved or whoever's involved, and they didn't in themselves request that the neighbors be involved. I think that there was some history of contention between the neighbors, and the parents, particularly the father's approach was that, you know, that I just don't want to be bothered with it. There was a history of racial, there was an interracial couple, an African-American male and a Caucasian woman, and they have, they had a young child, I guess middle school age, and they believed that he was receiving unfair treatment by some of the neighborhood children, which I think was actually fueled by some of the perceptions from older individuals who maybe weren't as comfortable with that, with his racial identity. In answer to your question, I'm not really sure why they weren't present.
Okay, that's very helpful. So this is an important example. Many of you may have seen the statistic that came out last month that you know, the majority of children in America today are not white, and also along with that statistic,
the high number of children who are biracial or identify as being mixed race. And so this, you know, this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. I self-identify as biracial. My father is African American and raised in the South, and my mother is white and she's from England. And so, you know, as I explained in the first webinar, when they got married in the United States, it was prior to U.S. v. Loving case, so it was illegal for them to get married in Virginia. And so, you know, this idea that there are so many people who are very uncomfortable with interracial marriage and with children who are the products of interracial marriages, and it's going to only become an increasingly prevalent issue because there are more and more kids who do identify as being biracial or mixed race. And so the question here, you know, within the children peer group, so I would break this down into several levels. There's, you know, the children to children level of communication, and then there's the parental level of communication. And so for kids, obviously how we're going to approach talking about issues of race and identity is very, very different. And, you know, I have a daughter who I am concerned about, you know, her growing up and her having to deal with things that I wouldn't want her to have to deal with. And so the thing that I often explain to her teachers and others who are involved in childcare is that it's important for children to understand the range of identities in the world. So if you live in a community that does not have a lot of diversity with regard to identity, most people self-identify as being the same, it's important that kids there understand, even though they're not seeing it day to day, that they see it in books, they see it, you know, in the limited, hopefully limited television that they watch, that they see that there's lots of possibilities in the world, and globally, that people look all kinds of ways, and they have different histories and different cultures, and all of those are to be enjoyed and appreciated. So really doing, going the extra mile to make sure that children are exposed to that, so that in their middle school setting, when someone is different because of whatever, that the differences are not treated as being necessarily negative. And that's a very difficult thing to do because cognitive development at that age certainly suggests that children are trying to do groupings based on same and different. And so a lot of work has to be done to overcome, you know, what's happening for that level. For the parents who don't want to participate, maybe weren't available, didn't know about it, who may not see that there's a problem, who may not either want to believe that their children are engaged in certain behavior, it's again, I think approach you can take there is to engage the group in a joint information sharing activity. So once people start to understand how human beings deal with differences, with bias, with stereotypes, this is some of the information I provided in the first webinar, and some of the cognitive science about how our brains actually work, that can help people change their minds. So there's a great book called Changing Minds by Howard Gardner, who's a professor of education and cognition at Harvard, and it's about how do you actually change people's minds when they're set on a particular point of view. Now, I'm not suggesting that everyone should go out there and try to change minds. What I am suggesting is that one of the techniques that he suggests is that when people learn new information, their brain actually opens up to have new perspectives. And so that's an important tool for a neighborhood or community or school-based situation like this, where oftentimes people don't know what the consequences of their perspectives are. And once they have empathy about how it's affecting children, and hopefully that can be something that most people can identify with, they might be willing to engage in learning more information together with the group and doing sort of joint problem solving. So what do we see that the problem is, and how can we as a group, as parents of this particular class, work together? And so those are just some basic techniques, but I'm happy to talk to you more offline.
Okay, thank you very much.
Anna, I'm wondering how you deal with it when a participant makes an inappropriate, uses a racial slur or something like that, you know, during the mediation in joint session. Or in private. Actually, I'm interested in how you would handle both.
So in the joint session, I think that's the harder of the two because, you know, as mediators, we're all trying to maintain some degree of respect from our clients. And if a client disrespects you as the mediator, you can quickly lose the mediation if you don't deal with it appropriately. So if a client says something that's racially insensitive or just straight out offensive in any regard, you know, I usually take the tack of stopping to have a conversation about that. So talking with the person, you know, why are you really saying that? So usually for, you know, my personal experience is that if they're using it to target me, they're using it as a way to derail things or to test me, to test how strong I am, to test, you know, am I going to, you know, be with them throughout the whole process or am I going to bail when things get difficult? And that being the reason that they're doing it, once we start talking about it, that comes to light. Now, if the situation is such that you have clients who are doing this to each other, that's a whole other level. And my tack is to absolutely stop things, separate, and basically talk in private to the person who said the words that were offensive and let them know that's absolutely unacceptable. If they didn't, you know, if they're sort of like, well, I didn't know or I didn't mean to, I don't understand why that would be offensive, then that's another conversation that has to be had. And sort of, you know, there is no universal rights or wrongs about what words are not offensive. But if somebody across the table from you is telling you that that's offensive to her or him, that's enough. And so that's guidance that you should try to reframe what you're saying in a way that's not offensive. Just out of the goal of having mutual respect. So in terms of a private situation, I try very hard to use it as a learning opportunity. Oftentimes I find that people don't know how to talk about culture, race, and ethnicity. So they say things, and they know it's not the right way to say it, but they say it anyway. And so after they say it, then it's like, well, what was I supposed to say? And you know, aren't we going too far? I once worked with a judge who was from another country who was a mediator, becoming a mediator in the United States. And in her country, there were different words for people who were black. And those words in a different language translated into words that were very offensive in the United States, and the N-word in particular. And so I had to explain to her why she couldn't use that word when she was mediating in the United States. And she really didn't understand it. And at first she didn't want to understand it and thought, well, isn't this being overly sensitive? You know, it's a different country. We have different ways of saying things. So what's the big deal? But after she understood why, then she was more inclined to work around her language and figure out ways to treat everybody with respect. So, I mean, obviously we all know this, and the goal is to have people treated with dignity and respect. And if your clients in mediation are going out of their way not to do that, it's usually because of something deeper going on, and that's worth figuring out a way to explore.
So any comments, questions?
Hi, this is Kathleen. One of the things that I found in, you know, in those kinds of situations is that almost instinctively the mother in me comes out and I want to reprimand the person who spoke inappropriately about another person's identity. And yet, you know, as soon as you know, we go into the reprimandal or mode where the client can feel shamed, then we're doing a backslide, not moving forward. And what I've done in situations where that has come up is I've said to the person being spoken about, I will say something along the lines of, you know, I think I just noticed a reaction from you just then after the person across the table just spoke. Did something just come up for you? And can you tell me what, you know, what just happened? Was there a reaction? What was it? Can you explain to us what's happening for you right now? And very often, they will be the one to initiate then saying that, you know, yeah, you just called me the N-word or whatever, and then talking about what that means to them, and then just inviting the other person without necessarily trying to change their views. If they have a racial bias, I don't necessarily consider in a mediation that it is necessarily appropriate to try to change their racial bias, but more to do as you were saying, Anna, where we create an arena of dignity and respect, or dignity and respectful behavior at the table. And so sometimes just by inviting the other person and acting as though I didn't know the insult was intentional, you know, leaving the intention of insult away from the table and just simply saying, so hearing that this other person shuts down when they hear that word and they begin to feel offended and so their barriers go up, and recognizing that that's going to be difficult for negotiation, would you be willing to avoid using terms that trigger that reaction in this person so that we can have a successful negotiation? And you know, I don't know whether that's a right or wrong approach, but I think that sometimes it's the best approach to assume that a person's intention was not insulting and that they were just ignorant of the appropriate term to use, as was the woman you were describing from another country.
So thank you so much for sharing that example, because it allows me to talk about something which I wanted to raise, which is our identities as mediators. So the minute we walk into the room, our clients are looking at us, they're assessing us. How old are you? What clothes are you wearing? Do you look experienced? Do I think I can trust you? In the first 5 minutes, that's all that's happening. And you know, the technique of inviting everyone in the room to feel free to voice and say, look, whatever he or she just said is offensive to me, here's why, and vice versa, is one that can work well, but it often hinges on the identity of the people in the room. So if you have a mediator who shares an identity, obviously each one of us has a racial identity, and if our identity is the same as one client but different from the other client, and if that other client is a person who has in their life experience feels marginalized because of their racial identity, i.e. they've been discriminated against, they feel that people walk around treating them differently and in a negative way, then the fact that you as a mediator do not share their racial identity makes them maybe feel uncomfortable if you're calling upon them to explain or talk about why they are insulted. And so that's something that one has to be cautious about doing before you've developed adequate trust with all your clients, and also established equal footing, that in the mediation room, unlike out in society, you know, we're going to have or try to encourage a degree of openness where people can say, you know, I'm going to try my best here to say what I need to say. I might get it wrong. Feel free to correct me or explain why you think that's offensive. So if everyone's engaging in the conversation from that same baseline from the beginning, that can work sometimes better than after something comes up, the mediator's pointing to the person who may or may not be offended and saying, you know, are you or aren't you? Because sometimes that person may feel vulnerable. Now, that's not always the case. And all of this, obviously, each one of us has to make the call in the moment. But I do think there is something to be said for a mediator. If you see in your particular case, these things are going to come up, to in the beginning mention it and say, look, you know, this is my view on how identity plays into a particular dispute. And explain to them a little bit about the framework for why it's not just issues or interests, but why identity matters too. And in the beginning, you lay the groundwork where someone can say, oh, remember that identity thing you talked about? Here's where it's coming out for me. Here's where I'm comfortable, and here's where I'm uncomfortable. And it gives them permission to talk about things if they want to, while not feeling like they necessarily are put on the spot. And again, you know, who knows? Only you can tell in the moment if you think you're putting someone on the spot or not, and that's a call each one of us has to learn how to make.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I agree that as much premise and groundwork as you can lay in the beginning that you can then return to later on in the mediation, you know, that does create a good foundation. One thing that I've also found is that asking a person why anything seems to open a pathway toward defensiveness or a need to justify or you know, things like that. And so I find that if I use the what, you know, what about that felt offensive to you, that it gives them an easier way to be able to share their insights with us and to do it more in a story form rather or an observational form rather than a justificational form. And so I try not to use things like, you know, like why did you find that offensive, but more what about that was offensive. And it seems to create a different arena.
That sounds like a great technique. I very much agree. The other thing I'll just quickly mention is that I think, again, it's very important to set ground rules in the beginning, and part of the ground rules are mutual respect in terms of communication. And so, but also making it clear that people have room to make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. We're not all going to get it right. And if you say to folks, look, I want you to have, I try to have a conversation that might be difficult. It might be a bit scary. It might be offensive. I'm not asking for perfection as your mediation. I'm just asking you to try and to do so with the goal of trying to be respectful. And if we find that during this process we're not, then let's talk about that. And let's be honest with each other. And, you know, are you guys willing to engage in that? So giving them the choice and laying it out for them where someone feels like, okay, I don't know how to talk about this, but it's okay as long as I can try. And my mediator is going to help guide me if things get, you know, a little bit tricky. So, you know, again, I think setting the tone, it's very important as a mediator to yourself come to the conversation with not only an air of being comfortable, but also an air of encouragement and possibility that, you know, there's a reason why conversations like this are beneficial in mediation, and it can open up outcomes that you didn't necessarily have before. So encouraging people about the positives of having difficult conversations about identity.
Other comments, questions?
Well, we're almost at closing, and I just want to invite all of you to feel free to reach out to me if you have individual questions, and also just encourage you to keep the conversation going with each other in our professional communities. It's important that we as mediators support each other and we work together as we try to find ways to help others deal with these important questions. And I will just mention briefly for anyone that's interested that there will be a radio program this evening at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, where I will be talking on similar issues, but geared not to a mediator audience, but to the American public on the Texas Conflict Coach, Texas Conflict Coach radio blog, and that's at 8 o'clock Eastern Time this evening.
And how do people find that? Just Google Texas Conflict Coach?
Uh-huh, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Anna. Very enlightening, very helpful information, and I so appreciate your willingness to talk to us a second time. And I want to say happy Juneteenth to everybody.
Happy Juneteenth. Thank you all for joining the call. It was a pleasure to be here today with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.